Let's talk about some old books today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Liz Mercier has been examining some rare old books at Purdue University. We'll ask what she's found on Scribble. Rare old books. Liz, explain. How did you come into some rare old books?
Well, I teach Latin and Greek at Purdue, and a very good friend of mine was working on the West Coast, on a stage production, a major stage production. And on the first day working on the production, was asked to take a straight razor and cut pages out of extremely old rare books and make scrolls out of them. And it's a very close friend who knows me quite well. And as soon as a snack happened or a lunch or a bathroom break, he rushed off and gave me a phone call and let me know that he was fairly certain that many of these books were in Latin and Greek and that they were very, very rare books and that there were likely Bibles among them. And that started a two-year odyssey of trying to secure the donation of those books after the production ended. It's a very, very long process. And in the end, in August of this past year, I received from the West Coast, I paid shipping, 10 pallets of books. Many of them are still in boxes, and so I have no idea of what I have, but the oldest of the books are too large and too awkward in shape and size to fit into standard cardboard boxes. And so far, I've inventoried about 500 books, a little bit over that, that date between the oldest is 1479, and the 500 of them are pre-1799, I'll put it that way, are earlier than 1799. It's an extraordinary collection of sampling of books from all over Europe at the dawn of printing.
So it's a whole library, kind of?
Well, the books come from, I don't really know exactly. When I got the deed of gift, signed the deed of gift, it was unclear to me exactly where. I'm not sure the production company kept track of exactly where the books came from. They were acquired from a number of different sources, but I'm not sure exactly even where they came from, but they're on all different kinds of subjects from all different kinds of countries. And obviously, because of their age, a huge number of them are in Latin and Greek and are theological texts that I can use in my classes at Purdue.
So had they been a library, or do you know?
Oh, no, they weren't a library. They were just from antiques dealers it boggles the mind. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine that they would come from a bookseller. I mean, I don't think there's any bookseller that would know anything about any book that would donate a 1479 incunable Bible for mutilation
right.
For a stage production. So presumably they came from antique shops or junk shops or something where some of these old books are dusty, right? They're dirty. Some of them have red rot, which is the decomposition of the leather on the covers. And I think whoever donated them had no idea what they had.
That's extraordinary. How did that wind up in Hollywood? I don't get it. I realize, who was it? Frank Lloyd Wright said the United States is tilted and everything loose winds up in Southern
right,
California.
Right.
But you wouldn't expect to find a load of antique books in a stage setting in Hollywood.
What's really perplexing is why they didn't just use modern materials to make to make scrolls. I mean, you know, cutting out, extracting pages from books that are hundreds of years old and gluing them together is just, I mean, that it kind of boggles the mind. The other thing that they did was they made large movable set pieces by driving enormous poles through stacks of the books. So they would put the books at different angles and they would drive these enormous poles through the stacks of the books, and also screws that are, you know, a good 4 or 5 inches, you know, long to hold them together. And then they could move them around the stage rather easily then.
Well, how did the production company get the books in the first?
I mean, the production company was wealthy enough so that they could just say, we need these for the production, and send scouts out to the surrounding area to procure them from these antique sellers or wherever they came from.
But it doesn't make sense. You know, you could go to almost any source and get a bunch of contemporary books. You could dust them and they could look old.
Absolutely, it's absolutely heartbreaking. And not to jump too far ahead, but I've been, you know, working with students now for a full year, students and colleagues, in terms of inventorying things. And there was one particular day where we were in the warehouse where they're stored. We go there on Friday afternoons and work for several hours after classes are over and hunt, you know, search through the books and come up with a very cursory inventory just so we know what we have. And someone pulled out of a box a Bible, a Dutch Bible from the 1700s, and they had taken some kind of a saw to it, and they had cut a square from the opening of the book into the book so it was shaped like a C. And it even had a card. It even had a card from an auction house sticking out of it that said that it was a Dutch Bible. And I mean, it was just heartbreaking. We all kind of gathered around it and had a moment of silence. I mean, it was really, you know, what do you do in a situation like that? It's almost horrific to see how many years it's survived and all the history that it held, and then to see it mutilated in such a way. It was really shocking.
So are these books you can use in your own teaching?
Absolutely. So I teach all levels of Latin and Greek, and so I'm very excited to incorporate them into my Latin and Greek classes. I plan to do that. And I've also developed a course in the Honors College at Purdue, just kind of on book history. One of the really wonderful things about the whole tragedy of the mutilation of these books is that they're no longer, these are not collectors' prize pieces. These are not things that antiquarian booksellers or dealers are going to be interested in, particularly if they're damaged. But they are wonderful teaching tools because they are in rough condition. And the rough condition exposes how the quires were sewn together and binder's waste that might have been tucked in the spines from earlier manuscripts. And loose pages have watermarks, you know, from the printing mills from hundreds of years ago. And so even though it might look like a sad pile of discards to someone else, for me it's an extremely rich and valuable collection to mine for all kinds of studies by students, both students that read and learn Latin and Greek with me in my language classes, and also just students of English, just for book history purposes, the history of the book. Not all of them are in Latin and Greek by any stretch of the imagination. There are many books in other languages. We have some Spanish and Italian and English and French and German books, and they come from all over Europe.
You wonder how they got here. I mean, it's crazy. you think that people just brought them over with them, or I find it incredible. I know Hollywood is a place that's full of surprises and outrageous things, but this just doesn't sound possible.
Well, universities are often repositories for books from you know, all over in other countries, and monasteries. I mean, monasteries, there are valuable collections of books, but they made their way here.
Will they be part of the Purdue Library, or are they in bad shape?
They're really not archival quality in terms of in terms of their condition. However, their value is definitely, you know, they definitely have archival value. And so they could be, many of them could be in the, you know, possibly in the Purdue archives. But what I'm most immediately interested in is using them as a hands-on teaching collection for students. And, you know, we're really at a crossroads here in terms of the use of books. I mean, we're becoming a digital world.
Right.
And people are walking around with Kindles and losing the whole aesthetic of sitting with a book and smelling a book and turning a page and taking a note, taking notes in the margins. And part of what I think is so marvelous and timely about this donation is that I hope to reinvigorate a sense of appreciation for the physical book and the story that each book has to tell. I mean, these books have had a story. They have had a history. They have been, how did they get there? How did they
right.
get to the West Coast? I mean, it's fascinating. And I hope to enliven that in my students.
Well, I have heard that Kindle is being used less and less these days, and people, in fact, are going back to books.
I hope so.
Because
I mean,
there is something about holding a page, particularly of an old book like this, that, you know, I don't know whether I'm making it up in my mind, but I have to hold a book.
Roald, I am exactly the same way, and I honestly feel that if the two of us feel this way, there have to be others. Don, I'm sure you would agree, there have to be others in the world that feel similarly. I mean, holding a book and reading a book is a completely different exercise than getting something off of a screen. And an interesting analogy is CDs. You know, when CDs
right.
came out for music, my husband, who's a huge jazz person, would always talk about the quality of the CD, but there's record players are coming back.
Yeah,
people want
right.
records.
Vinyl is back.
Vinyl
yeah.
is huge. It's back. And that's part of it is the aesthetic.
Sound is better.
Yeah, it's the whole experience of the record player, and it's just a completely different way to take in music. And I think books are here to stay.
You know, I have a different approach to books from a lot of people. You mentioned people writing in margins. Do you do that, Tweet? Do you
I don't. My wife does. I don't.
I have a reverential attitude toward even the junkiest book. I don't want to mark it. I don't want to put my name in it. I don't want to do anything. It's a book, so you don't mess with it.
Can I tell you that I feel exactly the opposite?
The minute
I get a book, I want to immediately move in. I want to move in, and I want to set up my furniture and figure out what room I'm going to put this plant. I always write in my books, and it's really been kind of an interesting journey for me because for the last 3 years I've been working with medieval manuscripts, and so I'm kind of taking my studies backwards. I started as a classicist, and then I have done 3 summers, 2 in Toronto and 1 at Rome, doing nothing but medieval manuscripts. And now I'm working even more modern, if we can say it, to early modern European print. But it's fascinating to get medieval manuscripts on vellum and have those marginal notations.
Right.
They are absolutely fascinating. And they're so helpful in terms of determining who used this book. How was this text received at the time that it was written? You know, what was the reaction to the book? I mean, it's incredibly valuable, those little notes in the margins.
Except, I agree with Don, except if they're written by me, right?
Well, you know,
then I'm just making a used book out of it.
Yeah, that's true. But whenever I'm reading a book, I think, oh, I got to note this. And rather than mark a book or something, I'll get a separate piece of paper and I'll write down the page number and something. And then the other day, I thought, I'm going to mark in this book. And I don't remember if I actually did or not, but I remember the impulse is, why don't you just underline the blasted sequence, you know, and put a note here so you can find it. And whether I did or not, I can't say because I hate to violate a book. You are a despoiler of books, Liz.
No, it's marvelous. I feel like I've got to add another little piece to the story. So when I buy a book, and I buy many books, I only want to buy used. If I could pay the same price for a brand new book or a used book, I'm much more interested in the used book. And I don't know if that's something quirky about me. I want to know who else moved in. What did they find in it? What did they find interesting? Why were they there? I think the whole story that the book itself presents and its journey from one hand to another, from one place to another, that almost fascinates me more than what's between the pages.
You are a more legitimately a book lover than either Tweet or I think.
Have you come across any books that are so rare that they weren't known before?
Well, I don't know if I could say that, but certainly many of the materials that we have are very rare and very valuable, and I've shared the inventory with a number of colleagues in a number of different contexts, and just from my own reading, I'm quite sure of that. The oldest book that was rescued, and this one was not mutilated, which is remarkable, is a 1479 incunable Bible. So incunables are incredibly valuable, and you both probably know that an incunable comes from the Latin word incunabulum, which means cradle. And so incunables are those books which were printed from, let's say, Gutenberg, roughly 1455 through 1500. So anything that is 1500 or earlier within the first, 50 years of printing is called an incunable, and they have a particular value. And the Bible that was rescued from this production, I mean, it is absolutely gorgeous. And it's printed, but it's hand rubricated. So scribes were still active at the time. And so they would put it through the printing press, but the rubrications, in other words, the markings in red of the beginnings of the chapters of the Bible and the beginnings of the verses of the Bible were hand done by scribes. And they scribbled all over the first page. There are some little grotesques and a dog that looks like he's coughing or vomiting that's on the front and whimsical things that add to its value and its uniqueness.
So how would a book like that get in a pile of books that are intended to be ripped up for scrolls?
I have absolutely no idea. The only thing that I can think is that the person who had those books prior might have been an antiques dealer, so they knew that these books were very, very old. They probably didn't read Latin and didn't know where to look in the book. You really have to know, because there aren't title pages in a book from 1479. Right. You have to go to the very back of the book where there's a colophon, what's called a colophon or a finishing touch in the book, where they say the year and where it was written and by whom it was written and that kind of thing. And obviously it was some kind of a person who collected or sold old things but had no real interest in its value. And it's not the prettiest, the prettiest book on the page. I mean, it's a very, very old book, and it's got wormholes.
But you think a dealer would know.
You would think. But.
But don't you think, I look around my house, and I think sometime in the not-too-distant future, I'll be gone. And all the junk, and I'm sure most people would consider it junk, that I've collected, all of a sudden, the guy who was around and organized this around him, well, if you want to call it organizing, who sat him in the middle of all this is gone. So what do you do with this? And the immediate thing is, let's get rid of it. Now, all those books, and there are no rare books in there. There's some very beautifully bound books, a stack of folio books and so on. But what happens? What goes with all the records? And I'm sure that there were people who had these books, and they died, and the heirs said, let's get rid of this. And so it goes in quantity somewhere. And wherever it goes, it moves again and moves in a lump.
Yes, and I think that's very true. Many of them have auction cards. Mm. And so, they were purchased at some point, in an auction, and we all know how auctions work.
Right.
I mean, you want one thing in the box,
right,
and the rest of it you just kind of want to jettison. And I think that's another way that many of them probably came to land somewhere where they weren't valued.
You know, it takes you back to a time when you look at Shakespeare's will, his second best bed, which is the one he and his wife occupied, because you didn't sleep in the best bed. You saved that for guests. And so that was a very moving endowment to his wife. But generally, when people had things to pass on in the past, there wasn't much, just a few items. But now, in this material world, we have accumulated so much stuff that we don't need, that we seldom, if ever, use. It's just there. And
well, that makes all the more perplexing, though, in some sense, how this incunable Bible could land in a situation where it was meant for the trash heap. Because many times, years and years ago, and books were scarce. I mean, the only book you might have in your house would be a Bible or something like that. And a Bible is something that generally is handed down from generation to generation if it is valued. And so that makes it even more perplexing, I think, how some of these books, because there are a number of Bibles in the collection, and they kind of stand alone in the sense that they're treated differently as household mm-hmm. possessions. And, you know, they would be Bibles held records. I mean, when someone right. died or gave birth or got married, those records went into Bibles. And so it's more perplexing, I think, when I see a Bible as opposed to some other kind of a book. But and they aren't all Bibles by any stretch of the imagination. There are wild dictionaries on all kinds of things, you know, a French dictionary on gardening from the 1700s and just, you know, absolutely fascinating
so
things.
So are they all European?
Well, I thought you guys might ask, and so I wrote down some just now we've only just scratched the surface in terms of the 10 palettes.
Right.
But so far we have things from England and France and Italy and Scotland and Germany and the Netherlands and Belgium and Switzerland and Spain.
Do you have any novels?
There is some you know, it's kind of a strange hodgepodge. I was working at the warehouse shortly before coming to Iowa here for a visit, and we opened a box and it was all modern stuff. And I thought the production company must have never even opened right. all of the, because they right. were supposedly purchasing rare books. And these were, you know, David Sedaris is not a rare book, you know? I mean, that was one of the things that was in the box, yeah. you wow. know, much to my dismay, but nothing against David Sedaris. But
I just wondered, you know, because it's true, people would have a family Bible and they would collect dictionaries. But you wonder if you run into casual reading back in the 1500s.
Well, if I can just give you a little sampling of some of the topics, I think you'll get kind of a sense of just the vastness and the variety here. So not only Bibles, and some of the Bibles are in three languages at once. Like I have Bibles in Hebrew and Latin and Greek, column-wise, which are marvelous. I read all three of those languages. There are commentaries and concordances, obviously, for the Bible and theological tracts of various different types. There are also other kinds of things, though. There are writings on Christian martyrs and on church controversies, a thesaurus on sacred rites. We have a liturgical book that's filled with musical notation at the time when they only used a 4-line staff instead of a 5-line staff. There's histories of various sorts, Roman histories, a history of English, Scottish history on the Scottish barons, French history, monarchic histories in France, acts of British Parliament, a collection of the sufferings of the people called the Quakers from the 1700s, Howell's History of the World from the 1600s, a universal history from the earliest account of time to the present, dated 1744. I've got old dictionaries and languages like French, Italian, Latin, and Greek, but I also have that gardening dictionary I was mentioning in French from the 1700s, a dictionary of universal human knowledge from the 1700s, a dictionary of the arts and sciences, mathematical and philosophical dictionary, Lord Chesterfield's letters.
Wow.
I've got classical works from Cicero to Virgil to the Greek anthology to the Pandects or Roman law books of Justinian. I mean, it's just an absolute garden, marvelous sampling of early modern print.
And you've just tapped the surface of these. I mean,
yeah, but I do think that I probably got the oldest ones. If you've ever seen a really old book from the 1500s, right. I mean, you can carry one at a time.
Right.
I mean, they, you know, folio, the common of a, the right. common modern thought of a folio book is, you know, this dwarfs a full modern folio. They're ginormous, you know, gigantic right. books. But so I think I've gotten most of the old ones. I'm hoping there'll be some little gems that are small, you know, traveling books and portable books that will be among the David Sedaris and the rest of the modern stuff. But
I would be tempted to retire and just sit there and go
if
through
if I could,
books.
I would.
Well, you know, how many pallets remain unopened?
I would say 5 to 6. But again, they're the boxed books, and we were shipped. They're boxed, and so I'm assuming that most of those are probably going to be modern. But I would say 5 to 6 that have mm-hmm. many things that we have not touched or opened. So
it's sort of like Christmas every day.
It is like Christmas every day. It is absolutely like Christmas every day.
Now you say that these are books that you can use for students. To learn about how books are assembled, do you contemplate that means in any sense dissecting these books?
Well, I don't think the wonderful thing is they don't need to be dissected. Somebody's already mutilated them, and so we as horrific as that sounds, but I mean there are plenty of samples of books where the covers are missing or they have exposed spines, and I don't know if you know how much about book production, but the Bible, for instance, the Bible has medieval hand-scribed on vellum, on animal skin, much older material that was used in its binding. So it's an incunable from early print,
wow.
but it has
even earlier
vellum leaves that are much earlier that are visible and in the binding. And if you're a book collector or a book historian or know anything about that kind of thing, binder's waste can be very, very valuable. Uncovering it can be very, very valuable. And we have binder's waste where it's not from a book, but it's like a handwritten document for some purpose. And those are also fascinating because they say so much about the history of the time and what was waste, what was to be
right,
recycled,
right.
and what was valuable. And that changes with the times as well.
Yeah, I took a couple courses on rare books when I attended the University of Chicago, and I almost, my dream would be to become a rare books librarian. And
me too.
Know, check the watermark, and this paper couldn't have been written. You know, this paper wasn't printed until after. And I could just lose myself.
Me too. Once you get that bug, it never leaves you. And that's what I want to give to students. I want to make sure that the younger set can be intoxicated in that way. It just opens a whole world of history and art and literature and culture that is unlike anything else.
Do you see that happening to the students? That
they are crazy. Even I started a paleography class with my upper-level Latin students because I've been studying medieval manuscripts. And so I now offer a 300-level medieval manuscripts class. And those students have gone on to graduate school in classics, and they've gotten scholarships specifically because of their unusual, you know, ability to be able to work with these rare materials.
I must say, this is intoxicating, but it's also run us out of time. Liz Mercier, this has been fascinating. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Don Wooten with Roll Tweet. That'll do it for today, but we'll be back next week with another Scribble.